think about the last time you had to cancel a subscription. There's probably some waiting on hold, some guessing at your password, some mind-numbing small talk. And maybe, after all of that, you still weren't able to cancel it. Good news, it doesn't have to be this way, thanks to Rocket Money. Rocket Money tracks, manages, and can cancel your subscriptions for you. When you connect your accounts, you'll see a complete picture of all of your recurring subscriptions all in one place. Rocket Money organizes your subscriptions by due date and notifies you when something is coming up, so you'll never be caught off guard when you get charged. If you see a subscription you want to cancel, Rocket Money simplifies the process. Instead of waiting on hold for an hour, you can cancel it right from the app. Rocket Money will even try to get you a refund for the money you spent on subscriptions you forgot about. Stop wasting time trying to cancel subscriptions the hard way. Make your life easier and go to rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play Stores.
At Pluralsight, we don't just teach skills. We are building the tech workforce who deliver results fast, accelerated by top-tier content. Lead with confidence. Lead with expertise. Visit us at pluralsight.com to tap in and learn more.
In the tradition of The Perfect Storm and Into Thin Air, Rachel Slade's Into the Raging Sea is a nail-biting account of the sinking of the container ship El Faro, the crew of 33 who perished on board, and the destructive forces of globalization put the ship in harm's way. On the 1st of November 2015, Hurricane Joaquin barreled into the Bermuda Triangle and swallowed the container ship El Faro whole, resulting in one of the worst shipping disasters in decades. No one could fathom how a vessel equipped with satellite communications, a sophisticated navigation system, and cutting-edge weather forecasting could suddenly vanish. Until now, it is the subject of the book Into the Raging Sea by Rachel Slade. And Rachel joins me live on the line from the United States. Rachel, good afternoon to us. Good morning to you.
Good afternoon, or good morning for me, Charles. Nice to talk to you.
And you too. It seems incredible, doesn't it, that in the 21st century, when we can sort of track where our friends are via apps and we can order a pizza wherever we are in the world, that a ship like this could go missing and be unaware of the disaster that it was sailing into.
That's right. I mean, that's what makes this story so incredible. And of course, that's what for script B. I mean, this is really one of those classic shipwreck stories, right? And this is one of the oldest human dramas. Men, women, ships, the storm. I mean, you know, it goes all the way back to the Odyssey or Noah or the Tempest from Shakespeare, all the way up to Moby Dick and the Perfect Storm. But what's absolutely wonderful and terrifying about this story is that it's got a 21st century twist, which is that we actually recovered the black box, which had 26 hours of recordings of conversations on the bridge of that ship leading all the way up to her final moment.
So tell me a little bit about the backstory here. Tell me a little about the ship El Faro and her captain, Michael Davidson.
So this was an American ship. It was a Jones Act ship, which means it was protected by American maritime laws. And she was on her usual run between Jacksonville, Florida, delivering goods to Puerto Rico. And this was, as you mentioned, in late September. And what happened was this enormous storm just kicked up kind of out of nowhere. And it kicked up so quickly that the National Hurricane Center could not keep up with it. The other thing that's really interesting about this story and that we learn so much when we read the transcript of the conversations on the bridge are the pressures that captains are put under by the shipping companies to deliver goods on time. And Captain Michael Davidson aboard the El Faro was absolutely no exception. He was concerned about his future. He had been passed over for a promotion. It's quite likely that he would have lost his lucrative union job, American job, and he was scared. And I believe that he had a strong compulsion to prove to the shipping company that he was the kind of captain who would get his ship through on time.
When we're talking about the ship, by the way, I mean, we're not talking about a medium size or a small vessel here, are we? It's over 700 feet long.
That's right, yeah. It was almost three football fields long. That's American football fields. It was But what's interesting about the ship is that it was 40 years old. So something that a lot of your international maritime folks may not understand is that the U.S. Merchant Marine has been shrinking since World War II. And what we've got left in terms of commercial vessels are some very, very old ships. 40 years old is far too old. And it's not just that you can't replace the parts anymore for these ships. I mean, that's one problem. They were actually custom milling parts or taking them off of scrap ships. But the other problem is that regulations and designs have changed over these 40 years since we've had accidents. You know, we learned from those accidents. And so the way that ship was designed, it could not have been built today.
I mean, it really was. I mean, there were, the book describes how there were sort of holes in the deck. There were bits and pieces rusting away. I mean, it seems quite incredible that it was actually on a commercial route and going to sea. But this is, I suppose it's the way that the modern merchant marine does and the commercial pressures that are put on merchant marine captains in their actions.
I mean, that's the thing. We, you know, there is so much interest, of course, in saving money. And, you know, they had the shipping company, which was based in Florida, they had these ships. They had been running for decades. And there was no reason to think that they wouldn't continue to run. And so the ship did have vulnerabilities. It was sitting lower in the water than ever before. They had actually raised her plimsoll line, which means that she could take more cargo. And as you mentioned, she did have these openings. They were to ventilate the cargo holds, but they were now sitting lower and lower in the water. And so when the ship entered the hurricane and the wind started to cause a major list over to starboard side, those openings, the ventilation openings, got precariously close to the water and eventually just started flooding the ship.
And it sounds as well, I mean, we've heard this expression of the perfect storm before, and we all know because we've all seen the movie, you know, how quickly that one blew up. But this particular hurricane, Hurricane Joaquin, it came up so quickly that not even the National Hurricane Center could really predict what it was doing, and Captain Davidson certainly couldn't, because he was relying on basically ancient old charts in the way of sailing that's been done for hundreds of years.
Actually, what's interesting is that this story is also about the seduction of technology. So it wasn't that actually he had old charts. He had information coming straight from the National Hurricane Center, and that was coming through their dot matrix printers on the bridge of the ship. But it comes as alphanumeric code, so it gives the position of the storm and it gives you wind speed and then forecast path. The other forecasting system on the bridge of the ship was called Bon Voyage system. Now, if you saw it, you would recognize it. It's very intuitive. It looks a lot like Google Maps, actually. And the captain could actually plug in his course, and the weather system would then package the forecast and put it on that map as well. So now you have the ship's path, and you have the hurricane's path on the same map on this beautiful interface. And the captain could click to the next day and the next day and the next day, and he could see the ship safely pulling into port on October 2nd. So, and the hurricane pulling off to the north. The National Hurricane Center forecast, which I described before, the alphanumeric code, was telling a different story. So the third-party weather party system that the captain relied on had woefully outdated information on it, and it was incredibly misleading. And again, this is what happens when we have technology which seems so assuring, right? Like it confirmed what he believed, which was that the storm was going to pull north, that he refused to consider that perhaps it was wrong.
And he wanted to be seen as the sort of captain, as you said, the kind of guy who would deliver his cargo, his crew on time. He knew better. There were members of his own crew, his own first officers, and on the bridge there, who knew that perhaps this was outdated, and tried to warn Captain Davidson.
They absolutely did. I mean, that's what's so incredible about having the transcript of the black box, you know, 26 hours of conversations between the officers when the captain wasn't there and when he was there, trying to figure out why the third-party forecasting system was saying something contradictory to the National Hurricane Center. And in fact, the officers to the end didn't understand that there was this lag time between the third-party system repackaging of information and the National Hurricane Center forecast. So, in fact, they never figured out that the reason that he was getting this information was because what he was looking at was so outdated. And when you have this very fast escalating storm, those hours are critical.
The black box that was finally recovered from the ship, and it took a while to find where the ship was, because we tend to think, oh, well, if a ship goes down, immediately people know exactly where it was, what was going on. The Coast Guard are scrambled within minutes, and it doesn't work like that. And it took a very, very long time, didn't it, to find the black box of the ship and the ship itself.
Wow, you know, that is a story in itself, Charles, and I encourage people to read that book, because the first part is really the narrative that we got from the black box, including all of the conversations. But the second half of the book is about finding El Faro. And it was such a harrowing tale because El Faro truly disappeared. And you were talking about how you can track packages and track everybody, but we couldn't find the ship on the ocean floor. It was 3 miles down on the ocean floor, and we actually had to send a sonar scanner to search a field 200 square miles to try to find that hull on the ocean floor. It took weeks. When we finally did, we were shocked to discover that the very top portion of the ship's house was gone. The navigation bridge was gone. It had torn off the ship. They had to spend another mission just trying to find that section of the ship because that's where they knew the black box would be. They finally found the black box, but they didn't have the equipment to extricate it until August, which was almost a year after the ship had gone down. They sent down a robotic, tethered machine to extricate the black box. It was quite a lot of work. They brought it up to the surface and then spent 1,000 man hours. Can you imagine sitting there listening to this black box, transcribing the words? Because as you can imagine, as the storm kicked up, the audio got worse and worse and worse. And in fact, I wanted to mention that they spent one day. So this was a team of, I think, about 7 people. They spent one day trying to transcribe 9 minutes of that audio.
I'm just a bit stunned because I've got on my machine, in my computer, in which I'm talking to you now, on the left we have a research computer, and I just Googled up the ship, and it's a huge vessel, and I'm looking at the navigation bridge there, and it's a formidable piece of structure, and that was gone, and I'm just quite gobsmacked, and that just goes to show the tremendous stresses that must have been going on that evening or that day the ship went down.
They say that it took about 4 minutes for that ship to go from the surface of the water to the ocean floor. And it was probably traveling, and I apologize, I don't have kilometers on me, but it was probably traveling at about 45 miles per hour.
Wow.
And that's how the ship's house pulled away from, or the navigation bridge pulled away from the rest of the ship's house. And as she was going down that 4 minutes, she was shedding all of her cargo. So when they finally found the hull, you can imagine what the accident site looked like on that ocean floor. Just containers, cars, printers, bicycles, all the stuff of modern life strewn across a huge area on the ocean floor.
I'm quite shocked about that fact. I still am. And I'm just thinking about how harrowing it must have been for you to listen or to read the transcripts of these doomed men, especially knowing that most of the officers thought that the captain was wrong and he was proved wrong. It must have been harrowing to transcribe this, but also it must have been harrowing to go and talk to the families of those who perished.
That was absolutely, Charles, the most difficult thing that I had to do. And it took me a long time to build the courage to be able to call people. And some of people, of course, didn't want to talk to me. They don't want to talk to media. They don't want to talk to journalists. But the families that did were very generous. And that was critical. To be able to talk to them was important to me, because what I really wanted to do with this book was humanize this tragedy, to show that these were men and women just like you and me, getting into a more and more precarious situation. And what's fascinating, too, is that, you know, the conversations on that bridge, some of them are very mundane. And even, you know, in the most prosaic moments when they're talking about getting coffee with Splenda, and you know what's going to happen to them, it's those moments that you really realize these are people. And now we know so much about them.
It would have been quite easy just to sit there and do, you know, if you like, a basic, and I'm not demeaning anybody here, but a basic, because I earn a so-called living out of journalism as well, but just to do almost like a cut-and-paste job. You've got the facts, you've got some backstory, you've got some quotes, you meld them all together, you've got the accident reports, bang, you've got a book. But you did something a little more different. You decided that the only way you were going to get under the skin of this book and find out what the men went through and what it's like was actually to go out yourself and go on a container ship in a route that took you past Gibraltar. Now, as I'm doing this story, I can look out from the windows of the studio here, and I can see Gibraltar in the far distance. So tell us a little bit about...
I thought so, yeah.
So tell us a little bit about what that was like and how that helped your research.
So first of all, that was incredible, Charles, and I really encourage anybody who's never done that before to jump on a container ship. You're so lucky you're in Europe. You can do that. Here in the United States, we're not actually allowed to embark on ships that way. So, yes, I boarded a ship, a Grimaldi ship in Italy, and I took it through right by Gibraltar and out to sea. It took 12 days to arrive in Baltimore, Maryland, in the U.S., and it was absolutely fantastic. We had beautiful weather. But also I was writing this book. And so I was on the bridge of the ship watching the officers and the helmsmen and the mates and the captain interact all throughout the day and the night, because, you know, these ships run 24 hours, of course. And that really informed my writing. I was right there. I was on the bridge of the ship, and I was writing while I was observing all this. It was a profound experience. It was also profound to be so unplugged. I mean, once you get out to sea, you're beyond communication. Obviously, there's no cell service. They didn't have any web service. It was, you're cut off from the world. And for people who are looking to unplug, I think it's absolutely the best way to do it. There's nothing to do on a working ship but stare out to sea, or in my case, stare out to sea and write a book.
And you talk about at one point of the being off the coast or somewhat, just being out to sea when they cut the engines off and it's just you and the sea and nothingness, which is quite something.
That was pretty incredible. Yeah, they cut the engines off several hundred miles before we arrived in the United States. So we had been at sea for quite a long time. And, you know, the drone of that enormous engine that's driving that huge propeller just becomes part of your daily life, of course, when you're at sea. To be in the middle of the ocean in silence aboard such an enormous vessel was absolutely profound.
It's not only
it was one of the best moments.
Sorry, it's not only a tale, of course, of the crew of the El Faro, but also it's also a tale of the Coast Guard and the men and women who, when everybody else is taking shelter, risk their lives to climb aboard aircraft, to climb aboard vessels, and go and try and find those in distress. And there are some quite heroic stories about them as well.
Yeah, you know, I spent a lot of time with the Coast Guard after this. They, of course, were involved with the federal level investigation to find out what happened, and they were really searching in earnest. And, you know, in the United States, when you see federal workers doing really good work like this these days, it is a pleasure. But the reason that they were so involved, of course, was because they're in charge of regulating American ships, but also this storm sat over the accident site of El Faro for days, and it actually intensified. So it became a Category 4 hurricane after the ship went down. And that prevented the Coast Guard from getting in there to try to rescue any survivors. But, man, did they try. They sent in helicopters. helicopters, they sent in planes, they sent in cutters over several days. They sent in a huge number of forces trying to find survivors. And, of course, unfortunately, they found almost nothing.
What was it like then when you sat down to write this book with all the backstory that you knew, and by this point you had heard the voices and read the transcripts of those who had perished and listened to the relatives and spoken to the people who were there in terms of the Coast Guard who tried to get to the site of the ship? Wasn't there a point where you thought, I can't do this, this is a huge story to write, and if I get this wrong it will damage people?
You know, that happens to every writer. After doing so much research, talking to the family, talking to mariners, talking to the Coast Guard, talking to the National Transportation Safety Board, having gone on a ship, having piloted ships with actually the pilot who took El Faro out for her final run, after absorbing all of that information over a year and a half, that story just flowed out of me. And at that point, it became a mission and an obsession. I had to speak for the dead mariners. I had to tell their story. Of course, there was fear that I wouldn't tell it properly, but the fear was much less than the need to tell their stories, the need to tell Americans about their own shipping industry and what dire straits it's in, and to share the story with all mariners about, you know, communicating on the bridge, trying to understand discrepancies in weather forecasts, being aware, being afraid. You know, all of these things are very human emotions that these are important lessons we need to learn and can apply to all walks of life, not just, of course, in the shipping industry.
There's always that moment when you've done the final edit and you hit the send. I mean, in the old days, you post the manuscript off, but now you just hit the send button and it's gone. What do you think? What was it? What were your feelings when it was finally gone out there? And what has been your reaction been like to the praise it's getting? And also, what do you hope that the book will teach people? And how do you hope it changes?
So when I press send, of course, it comes back to you because, you know, you have to go back and forth with your editor a bit. And then you look at that final draft and it's like, that's it. You know, you have to sign off on it, and you hope that there aren't errors in there, and you know that there are because there are thousands of facts in this thing. I mean, it's just packed. But I wanted to release it to the wild. I really, really did. I was looking forward to getting feedback, most importantly from the families and from mariners, but also to find out whether it was resonating with people who had no connection to the sea. For me, I wrote it as much for mariners as for folks who didn't know anything about shipping, to really orient people to the beauty and the danger of life at sea. So far, it has been a tremendous response. I'm very excited to say that the New York Times book review is coming out on Sunday. I've seen an advanced review of it. It seems to really be resonating with a lot of people. I mean, this is the perfect storm, but we know what happened. We have those transcripts. We have those conversations. We know those mariners and their final words. So I think this is an unprecedented sea story. I think it's an incredibly gripping thriller. Other people have told me that too. It's also imbued with a lot of history and information. So I kind of sneak that in because that's the kind of book I would want to read, something that teaches you a lot without anybody knowing, right? But the response has been really, really incredible. And the changes, I would like to say that I just got an announcement yesterday from Carnival Cruise Lines. They have installed an enormous control center in their South Florida headquarters that actually tracks ships and tracks storms and tracks all the little details that are going on at the ships at sea. And I think this is the beginning of a real revolution for American shippers in terms of how closely they're following their assets. because I think there was some complacency, at least in this shipping company, and so I would have to assume in other shipping companies as well.
The book is called Into the Raging Sea. It's out, it came out yesterday on Echo, and it is by Rachel Slade. Rachel, if people want to find out more about you or by the book or about the whole SS El Faro, how can they find you? Presumably, is there a website? Do you do the social media thing? How can they get in touch?
Yes, please go to my website for more information. It's rachelslade.net. And the book is available internationally. It's on Amazon, of course, and it was put out in the UK by Fourth Estate Books. So it is available everywhere in the world. And, of course, that's very important to me because mariners are everywhere. But shipping is also everywhere. Shipping is what connects the United States to the world and what connects the world to the world.
And so, I'm looking now, and I can see it on the TRE website as well. It's on our virtual bookstore. I'm looking right at it right now. Only begs the question, Rachel, what's your next project?
I'm sorry?
What is the next project? What's your next book project? Are you going to keep away from shipping, or you just take a break from writing for a while?
Well, I mean, this is an incredibly intense story to work on, and I'm kind of emotionally drained, and I joke about how my next book is going to be about rainbows and unicorns. So keep an eye out for that.
We'll look forward to Rainbows and Unicorns by Rachel Slade. But in the meantime,
yes.
The book is called Into the Raging Sea. It's by Rachel Slade. Rachel, thank you so much for your time today.
Charles, it was a pleasure. Thank you.
Think about the last time you had to cancel a subscription. There was probably some waiting on hold, some guessing at your password, some mind-numbing small talk. And maybe, after all of that, you still weren't able to cancel it. Good news, it doesn't have to be this way, thanks to Rocket Money. Rocket Money tracks, manages, and can cancel your subscriptions for you. When you connect your accounts, you'll see a complete picture of all of your recurring subscriptions all in one place. Rocket Money organizes your subscriptions by due date and notifies you when something is coming up, so you'll never be caught off guard when you get charged. If you see a subscription you want to cancel, Rocket Money simplifies the process. Instead of waiting on hold for an hour, you can cancel it right from the app. Rocket Money will even try to get you a refund for the money you spent on subscriptions you forgot about. Stop wasting time trying to cancel subscriptions the hard way. Make your life easier and go to rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel, or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play Stores.
Marriott Bonvoy is the official hotel partner of U.S. Soccer. Join Marriott Bonvoy today to get closer to the game with exclusive perks, unforgettable experiences, and benefits that go beyond the pitch. Spring Hill Suites, part of Marriott Bonvoy, offers complimentary hot breakfast and spacious all-suite accommodations, perfect for the whole team, with room for up to 6 guests. Make your next getaway a win. Learn more at springhillsuites.marriott.com.